This podcast was created by the Arts and Junior Cycle team for the Junior Cycle Talks channel.
Hello and welcome to this podcast. I'm Anne Ryan, Arts Advisor with JCT. In this episode, we talk to independent film producer John Kelleher. During his illustrious career, John has produced many TV drama series and documentaries, as well as several films for cinema, including the 1980s feature Eat the Peach. Appointed official film censor in 2003, John was responsible for modernising what is now known as the Irish Film Classification Office. In our conversation, John discusses his career, shares insights into the films and filmmakers that have inspired him, and gives his views on the skills and qualities needed to be a successful producer. I began by asking him how he started in the industry.
I had applied to RTE and was lucky enough to be successful in one of their producer-director intakes. Every couple of years they used to take on producer-directors, and I was successful. Partly, I think, because I had been to the States and got a master's in drama, and they were looking for people who had done a little bit of travel and so forth. We embarked on a 9-month training course, which was fantastic. It was a real object lesson in every aspect of the television production process. We did things on the job. We were camera persons, or we were writing little scripts, or we were making little films, as well as having, if you like, academic tuition from very good people, guest lecturers and so forth. And it's a long time, 9 months intensive. That was like, 9 to 5 and weekends, very, very good experience. And then I became a producer director.
In RTE.
In RTE.
And which departments did you work in?
I tended to work initially in what was called the features department. So you're generally speaking doing a wide range of programming, and also in current affairs, which I liked. And then I was sort of promoted. So I took on executive responsibilities. I was assistant controller of programs and then controller of programs. And I had the chance to influence, if you like, the schedule. I'd been executive producer of a series called Strumpet City, which was one of their sort of flagship, a 7-hour drama. The scripts were written by Hugh Leonard, based on a really good book called Strumpet City by James Plunkett. And I managed to get Peter O'Toole, who was a very big star at the time, to play the part of James Larkin, and Peter Ustinov, who was equally a big star, to play the part of King Edward VII.
So you're working in RTE in some really exciting projects, but then you left RTE.
Yes, I left because I was invited to become managing director of a newspaper, which was not a career move that I think was a small one, because I was not particularly suited to being the commercial managing director of a newspaper. I did it for a short enough period, probably a year, year and a half, and then established my own company as an independent production company at a time which was quite difficult, because there was no independent production sector then.
This would have been about 1985.
Exactly 1985. And it was a very cold wind that blew. If you were outside the comfort zone of RTE, it's completely changed, I'm glad to say. Now it's a thriving independent sector, is certainly generating enormous volumes of production, and looking further afield, like co-production, international co-production, and Irish production companies, producers, are doing really well.
When did that change, would you say?
I think it changed probably during the 80s and then into the 90s. And there were a number of, I think, things which helped.
Like tax incentives.
Helped hugely, particularly in relation to film production, but more recently also in terms of television production, television drama. The establishment of T.G. Cahir, the establishment of TV3, as you say, the tax incentives, which helped. And gradually the sector grew and grew. There were also restrictions were put on the broadcasters that they had to commission, RTE had to commission a certain percentage. And then there was the creation of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, formerly the Independent Television Commission. Mm-hmm. All of these things helped.
And can you remember your first film production?
After I had left RTE and become an independent producer, yes, it was a film called Eat the Peach, which has been quite a large part of my life in one way or another. And it's ironic to look back. We made it in 1985. I co-wrote it with the director, whose name was Peter Ormerod. And it was very loosely based on a true story, the experience of two men in a rural area who see an Elvis Presley movie and they are inspired to build a wall of death, which is what Elvis rides in the movie. And there's a sort of an idea that this will make money, but it all came to nothing. I suppose it could be called a serious comedy, you know, a comedy with a message. And it did very well in Ireland, not elsewhere. It didn't quite strike the same chords elsewhere, but it was very successful in Ireland.
And was it very difficult to get funding for that particular production?
That particular one was not too difficult, but what happened was that Channel 4 became involved, the then Irish Film Board became involved, and we established, together with a colleague, David Cullen, we established a company and we actually raised money. People bought shares in the company, which was quite unusual. There was a government incentive called the Business Expansion Scheme, which worked.
And you were one of the writers on the film. So have you pursued writing as well throughout your career?
I wish I had, and I have often regretted the fact that I didn't, but there's only so many things that you can do. And I think if you're going to be a writer, you've got to be a writer. You know, you've got to go into that lonely place, you know, and work your 8 or 10 hours or whatever it is every day. I was in another place. I was in the place, which is a very different one, of trying to raise money, trying to bring together, trying to marshal the resources for filmmaking. And that's a very full-time job. So the answer to your question is regrettably no.
So as a producer then, and I know that you're still working, there's still a number of projects that you've been working on recently. What does a typical working day look like for you, if there is such a thing as a typical working day?
The last comment there is true. There isn't. There isn't, not as a producer, because it is so varied. It is so different. It is so dynamically driven, and there are constant problems that need to be addressed. It must be one of the most cooperative ventures. The nature of production involves so many different things, harnessing so many different things, from the financial to the logistical to the human, the personnel, things like casting, things like recruiting the team, and it is very much teamwork. I really don't think there is a typical day. The one thing that's certain is that there's certainly not a 9-to-5 day. No question about that.
And is there anybody who has inspired you in your work as a film producer that you could talk about, or any film maybe?
I think I always, from quite early on, I think I always adored cinema and wanted, if I could, to be in some shape or form involved in making it. There are lots of films that I've, you know, really loved. I mean, my favorite film of all time, for all kinds of reasons, is Casablanca. I'd watch it at the drop of a hat. You know, I must have seen it 40 times, and I'd happily see it 40 more. But if there was a person, I think there are many people that I've admired along the way. One person that I value him as a friend is David Putnam. And David is a remarkable man, and he's an inspiration. And I do remember him saying, it must be 40 years ago, at the Edinburgh Film Festival, I remember him saying, when making a film, if the producer and the writer and the director are not all on the same page, now there can be variation, he said, you know, there could be 5%, you know, difference in between their vision. But any more than that, that film is just not going to work. It's funny, I still remember that. And he's absolutely right. I mean, you have to know what it is that you're making. You know, you have to be really clear. You have to have your objective really clear. And then you can kind of deviate a little bit. You can have a little subtle variation in some aspect. It can even change. And in the case of certain things, like, for example, documentaries, they change. They absolutely change in the course of the making. It was the film about Lance Armstrong.
Armstrong, okay.
The one, the documentary that Alex Gibney was making, I think, where halfway through, it was starting out as a kind of a tribute to Lance Armstrong, winning his fifth or whatever it was, Tour de France. But halfway through, it emerged that he was a cheat and a fraud. And so the documentary that they were making suddenly became, in midstream, a very different beast.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
It's also exciting when
that
happens.
It is, yeah. And I think that The Artist and the Wall of Death, one of your recent projects, the documentary film there, there were a number of different directors. And
yes, and particularly in that case, it was more, not so much on the behind-the-scene personnel or the director, or the, you know, but as in what was actually happening to the participants. So what it started out as was not what it finished as. And it was a very interesting, in a sense, confrontation between people who were on different tracks. It was three men, you know, who were effectively wanting to build this wall of death. And two of them were on a different track than the third. And it came to a crunch, and they sort of parted company. And the documentary followed the person, the single man, whose vision was very different. And also COVID came into it. I suppose what it was a really good illustration of is that you can have a clear idea of what you want to do, but circumstances and events may change in the course of your making that. And you have to be able to adapt and follow the flow and go with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of flexibility that people need around that is really vital. Are there any particular themes or subjects or stories that have really sparked your curiosity during your career?
I'm very interested in current affairs and politics. So I tend to get drawn to subjects that in some sense are in that neck of the wood, rather than sort of purely imaginative or artistic. I did a documentary, for example, a feature documentary while I was in RT, which I really enjoyed, on the Spanish Civil War.
Okay.
That gave an opportunity to look at a political event which had world importance, but also to involve people who had participated in, this is a long time ago, this is, I'm talking about 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago that we made it. And we were able to interview and film men, they were all men, on both sides of that divide. It's about the Irish. It was called Even the Olives Are Bleeding.
What would you say is the most challenging aspect of film producing?
I think there are many, but I think that the most challenging by far was and remains and will always be raising the money. I mean, it is the ultimate problem that faces every producer. It's never easy. It's not a seller's market. You know, even though there's been this proliferation of streamers like Netflix and Amazon and Disney and Apple, which is fantastic from a producer point of view, from the point of view of content generation, and it's a much better pitch to play on now than it ever was. It still is not easy. It still is extremely difficult for every person who's commissioning some work. There are 100 people trying to pitch to them. That is really, really tough. The main thing that the producer does after that is bringing the resources together. And that can be challenging too, but it's infinitely less difficult, I think, because if you're financed, you have the money, the wherewithal to do the other things. You can pay cast, you can pay staff, the team that you put together, and you obviously try to get the best possible team in front of and behind the camera. But that's the most enjoyable part, I think, of being a producer, marshalling those resources and hopefully kind of creating and stimulating the environment within which the production comes into being.
And when you pitch for the money, where do those pitches take place and where do you get the opportunity? What do you have to do? Is it like, do you have to take every opportunity you can to meet people who would be potential funders?
Yes, yeah, there are a whole range of ways. I mean, most of the pitches take place by on paper, in the sense that they're often in response to an invitation that goes out generally, like RTE, for example, if it's looking for factual documentary series, will put out a notice which is circulated right throughout the entire industry, explaining exactly what they want. Or Screen Ireland is open at any time, you know, throughout the year to pitches. So if you have a documentary idea or you have a film that you want to make, you can submit it for looking for development or indeed production assistance. And then you go through a process of engaging with whoever the commissioning editor or the financier may be. So pitches can happen in a variety of different ways.
Okay. And then do you remember that film with, I think Tim Robbins was in, you know, is it The Player or?
Yes.
Where there's that famous pitch clip, example. Is there ever a situation where you'd have to pitch like that verbal kind of 2 minutes or something?
Yes,
like
I mean,
that?
The famous Hollywood thing is, 25 words or less. Exactly.
So it's obviously really important.
I think it's absolutely crucial, and you only get one chance to make an impression, and you're competing, against many competitors.
We were talking earlier about how it's so collaborative and it's the most cooperative job you can do, really, being a producer. But around the key skills of the Junior Cycle framework, which key skills do you think are needed to be a successful film producer?
There are some pretty obvious ones. I think common sense is one. Having a good idea of the area, of what are people looking for, what are the pitfalls, to have an overview of what it is, of where it is that you're kind of pitching into.
So your audience, really.
Your ultimate audience and your audience that helps you to get there, which is the financier, or the commissioning editor, the person who's listening to your pitch. You have to get past them. They're the gatekeeper. You've got to get past them. But then also people skills. I think that's incredibly important. A producer has to be able to deal with a huge variety of different kinds of people and different kinds of skills. Some of them are technical, some of them are financial, some of them are temperamental. you have to be a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
You probably don't have to be a master of all trades. Perhaps maybe not a master of none, but you don't have to be a master of too many, but you have to have an understanding of all, I think, and the ability to harness all of those different resources and people.
And get them to work together. So I think you have to be a people person, really, don't you?
You totally have to be a people person. You also have to be really good, at least good at appreciating deadlines. I mean, that is crucial. Like, time is money. It applies probably to the film business as much as to any business. And, a half a day lost could cost a huge amount on your budget. So you have to be really good at thinking ahead. I think that's absolutely crucial. The ability to think ahead, to foresee problems before they arise.
Yeah.
And if you have done that, if you've thought it through, that this could go wrong. What happens if that car doesn't get to this place at that time. What do we do? If the weather is absolutely appalling, what do we do? What's our rain cover? So if you think through all those things, you're going to be in a much better place when the problems do, and they will come.
And they will come. That sounds great. Well, it sounds challenging, but it sounds good too. The role of the producer is something that teachers might be interested in supporting their students to learn about. Is there any advice that you might give them?
I've always kind of defined the role of the producer as making it happen. I said the producer's job is to make it happen. The director's job is to make it good. I think the best advice that I would recommend, you can't tell if someone's going to be a producer at an early stage, although they may have attributes. Certain people may clearly show attributes that will come into play and be of advantage later. Like organizational ability is a huge one. You know, leadership is another. But I think that with producers, it's something that kind of comes later. You're not born a producer. You gravitate towards it. And the interesting thing, and it's a very positive thing in a way, is that anything that you do in the course of your study or in the course of your life or aging people who are growing up, anything that you do comes back and is an advantage. You know, so I often think that if a producer takes 2 years off and goes to the Himalayas or goes to Australia or wherever and is a chef, they're getting a life experience that can be brought to bear later. I mean, you know, being a chef is you're dealing with people, you're dealing with deadlines, you're dealing with bringing together a whole range of different things. So is producing.
What it is you do, you're developing transferable skills, really.
Totally. That's absolutely the case. I mean, it's really the case that there's almost nothing that you can do that won't in some shape or form come back to assist you and benefit you in terms of being aware of how to deal with the particular issue.
Okay. And then what might you suggest? How might a young person become involved in making films?
There's a number of different ways. I think that, you know, so you can get involved by doing it, by getting, you know, by going in at a low level, at a trainee level, into a particular area. Like you might have an aptitude for a camera, so you might get a job in some area within the camera department. Or it could be if you've got a proficiency towards sound, or if you're interested in almost immediately in the idea of producing, you could get a job in a production office, you know, as an assistant production coordinator or as a production assistant or as a trainee in that area. In the more creative sense, you could be a writer. So you write, you know, and then you take your chances and you send your work to producers or to various people. And there's a whole lot of ways, but I think the most important thing would be try to learn the business. Try to look at the business and see, you know, who is doing what. I've sometimes interviewed people for jobs in my company, and I'm astonished to find that they haven't researched what the company does. And needless to say, you know, they
didn't necessarily.
They're not working
in John Kellen Media.
Yeah.
You were appointed as the Irish film censor back in 2003. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
So could you just tell us a little bit about that? It's now called IFCO, which is the Irish Film Classification Office. But at the time, you were the censor, the film censor.
Well, for 80 years, I think that was the original name, and the Censorship of Films Act was one of the first pieces of legislation to go through the newly emergent Free State. We managed to get the name of the office changed to reflect what it now is, classification rather than censorship, if you like, from guard dog to guide dog. But I was very happy to have been able to do that quite quickly. So, was Irish Film Censors Office? It was easy to change it to Irish Film Classification Office, just a word, but it was a piece of legislative change. And then a few other changes to reflect the changing times, because, you know, censorship over the previous 80 or 90 years had reflected the state that it operated within. Cutting and banning films became a thing of the past, and classifying films by age were, particularly with consumer-related guidance for parents, became the most important thing.
Yeah.
And that is the most important thing that IFCO does today.
So there are still some differences, would you say, in terms
of... Well, there are differences.
Different countries.
Two different countries. And they're vastly different. For example, in France,
yes.
You know, where a film that might be over 18 in Britain or in Ireland might be 12 in France.
Yeah.
You know, quite different. And that's understandable culturally. But I think the Irish system, in a way, is more flexible than British, because in Ireland you have a 12A and you have a 15A. That allows a parent or adult to enable a person younger than 15. So if you're a parent and you've got a kid of 14 who's quite capable of seeing a particular film, they can go to it with you. I introduced the 16. It was an attempt to bring down the age to reflect the fact that young people were maturing in a way that couldn't have been envisaged much earlier. So over 18 was really kept for films that should really only be seen by adults. And 16 would enable, you know, people of 16, 17 to see certain films that they wouldn't hitherto have been able to.
Yeah. Is that something that you're interested in making a documentary about? Or can you talk about that?
Reading my mind. Yeah, I have an ambition to make... I'm actually working... I hope we'll get it off the ground, but I'm talking with Gabriel Byrne at the moment about looking at how the 100 years, because 2023 will be the centenary of the introduction of the Act, how censorship has reflected the social and economic and political and cultural history of the Irish state. So we hope to do that.
Okay, well, that's a brilliant pitch. Thank you so much, John, for being with us today. It's been fascinating listening to you. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Anne. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, which was created by the Arts and Junior Cycle team for Junior Cycle Talks podcast channel. To hear more from Junior Cycle Talks, search for us on SoundCloud or anywhere you listen to your podcast.